considering the consequences of such declines, University of Connecticut entomologist David Wanger, the package lead author, told the Associated Press that insects are absolutely the fabric by which Mother Nature and the Tree of Life are built. According to Wagner, many insect populations are dropping about 1-2% per year. As he put it to The Guardian, you're losing 10-20% of your animals over a single decade, and that is just absolutely frightening. You're tearing apart the tapestry of life. While most causes of declines are well known, there is one really big unknown, and that's climate change. That's the one that really scares me the most, he said, warning the crisis could be causing extinctions at a rate that we haven't seen before, he added. Roel van Klink of the German Center for Investigative Biodiversity Research told The Guardian that the most important thing we'll learn from these new studies is the complexity behind insect declines. No single quick fix is going to solve this problem. There are certainly places where insect abundances are dropping strongly, but not everywhere, he said. This is a reason for hope, because it can help us understand what we can do to help them. They can bounce back really fast when the conditions improve. The package's introduction points out that while much recent research and resulting news coverage focused on drops in bug populations, four papers in this special issue note instances of insect lineages that have not changed or have increased in abundance. Many moth species in Britain have demonstrably expanded in range or population size, the paper notes. Numerous temperate insects, presumably limited by winter temperatures, have increased in abundance and range in response to warmer global temperatures. Pollinators such as the western honeybee in North America may well thrive due to their associations with humans, the introduction adds. Increasing abundances of freshwater insects have been attributed to clean water legislation in both Europe and North America. In addition to the introduction titled Insect Decline in the Anthropocene, Death by a Thousand Cuts, the package includes seven perspectives. Agricultural intensification and climate change are rapidly decreasing insect biodiversity. To us insectometers, it is clear that insect decline in our Costa Rican tropics is real, so let's be kind to the survivors. Insects and recent climate change. The decline of butterflies in Europe, problems, significance, and possible solutions. A window to the world of global insect declines. Moth biodiversity trends are complex and heterogeneous. Deep learning and computer vision will transform entomology. No boss for bees. Media coverage of pollinator decline. The body of work also includes three separate research articles. Arthropods are not declining but are responsive to disturbance in Laquido Experimental Forest, Puerto Rico. Insect biomass decline, scaled to species diversity. General patterns derived from a hoverfly community. Non-linear trends in abundance and diversity and complex responses to climate change in Arctic anthropods. The final piece is an opinion laying out 8 simple actions that individuals can take to save insects from global declines, which features 5 actions to create more and better insect-friendly habitats, the loss of which is likely a leading cause of insect declines, and 3 that aim to adjust public attitudes. As Darna Noor wrote in her coverage for Earther, "I do not like bugs. Creepy, many-legged things make my skin crawl. But as unpleasant as they are, insects are absolutely crucial for our world ecosystem to function. And sadly, new research shows that the creatures' populations are on the verge of collapse." To boost awareness and appreciation of insects, the scientists suggest countering negative perceptions, pushing for conservation efforts, and getting involved in local political advocacy. On the habitat improvement front, they recommend converting lawns into diverse natural habitats, growing native plants, cutting pesticide use, limiting light pollution, and lessening soap runoff from washing vehicles and building exteriors, as well as the use of drive-away sealants and de-icing salts. Avoiding some behaviors or adopting others will contribute both directly and indirectly to insect conservation, the scientists note. Further, taking actions that address issues such as climate change can synergistically promote insect diversity. Climate change is increasingly recognized as a primary factor driving local and regional plant and animal extinctions.
Aperture.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
A song that has the fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises, may they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 नवंबर 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is the result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Nygren, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his Doctor of Philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama
Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
A climate model released by the prestigious scientific publisher Springer Nature offers a roadmap for meeting and surpassing the targets set by the Paris Climate Agreement, showing that we can solve the global climate crisis with currently available technologies and natural climate solutions. The book, titled Achieving the Paris Climate Agreement, was the culmination of a two-year collaboration with 17 leading scientists at the University of Technology, Sydney, two institutes at the German Aerospace Centre, DLR, and the University of Melbourne's Climate and Energy College. Stay with us for an article penned by the staff writers of OneEarth.com website, published under the heading Below 1.5 Degrees Celsius, a breakthrough roadmap to solve the climate crisis. Stay with us. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, warned in its special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, released October 2018, the Earth must be kept below the dangerous threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, above pre-industrial levels, if we are to avoid a worsening of climate-related impacts. We are already seeing the devastating consequences of the current 1 degree C global temperature increase, including rising sea levels in many coastal cities, extreme storms, prolonged droughts, and intensified wildfires. The impacts resulting from higher temperatures are almost unimaginable. The death of the coral reefs in every ocean, the collapse of nearly one quarter of the world's agricultural land, dramatically increased heat waves and wildfires. 100 million people driven to extreme poverty, sparking multiple refugee crises, 1 meter of sea level rise in some regions, and more than $11 trillion per year in damages from extreme storm and flooding. Stacked upon each other, these impacts and many more could undermine the very fabric of life on our planet, greatly challenging the continuation of human civilization as we currently know it. Up until now, it was assumed to be difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the carbon budget required to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, a maximum of 400 billion tons of cumulative carbon dioxide emissions from January 2018 onwards. Humans today release approximately 39 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions per year, mostly from burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. At other current level of emissions, we would only have 7 years to completely cease the use of all fossil fuels, which is clearly not feasible. While many scientists have modeled 1.5 degrees Celsius climate mitigation pathways to make the math work, almost all of them require the use of unproven and potentially dangerous geoengineering strategies like solar radiation management or bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model is groundbreaking in that it shows the 1.5 degrees Celsius target can be achieved through a rapid transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, 56% by 2030, alongside a major conservation effort to increase the resilience of natural ecosystems and help ensure greater food security. This includes a moratorium on land conversions by 2030 and 400 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions of negative emissions from forest and land restoration, which pulls carbon dioxide out of atmosphere and stores it in trees and soil. Co-author and editor, Dr. Sven Tesker, a research director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology at Sydney, Australia, said, "Scientists cannot fully predict the future, but advanced modeling allows us to map the best scenarios for creating a global energy system fit for the 21st century. And with momentum around the Paris Climate Agreement lagging, it's crucial that decision makers around the world can see that we can, in fact, meet global energy demand at a lower cost with clean, renewable energy. Some have doubted that a transition to 100% renewable energy is even possible. To explore the potential, the scientists created a sophisticated computer model of the world's electrical grids to date, with 10 regional and 72 sub-regional energy grids modeled in hourly increments to the year 2050. Along with a comprehensive assessment of available renewable resources like wind and solar energy, minerals required for manufacturing of components, and configurations for meeting projected energy demand and storage most efficiently for all sectors over the next 30 years. The result of the modeling effort shows that not only is it possible to switch to 100% renewable energy for all energy users, but it will cost much less to operate than today's energy system. Moreover, it will eliminate the toxic pollution associated with the burning of fossil fuels, estimated to be a primary cause of 9 million premature deaths per year. The renewable energy transition will not only improve public health worldwide, it will also drive economic development, providing the 30 million people currently working in the energy sector with permanent, well-paying jobs and creating an additional 12 million new jobs. The proposed energy transition outlined in the 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model will require investment globally of approximately $1.7 trillion per year. This sounds like a lot of money, but it pales in comparison to the vast subsidies governments currently provide to prop up the ailing fossil fuel industry, estimated at more than $4.7 trillion per year by the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Taxpayers are unwittingly funding the climate crisis, and that needs to stop. The research tells us that we could be creating the clean energy future we so desperately need for the less than one-third of what we're spending now, and in so doing, improve energy access in the developing world. There are five major components to the renewable energy transition. First is increased capacity to generate electricity, mostly through solar and wind power, enabling the electrification of all energy users, including power, heating, transportation, and even industrial users. Second is increased storage capacity in the form of battery arrays and pumped hydroelectric, which uses excess generation of pumped water up to a reservoir, releasing the energy when needed. Third is energy efficiency, decreasing overall energy consumption, especially in the developed world, by making buildings, cities, and vehicles more efficient. Fourth involves repurposing the existing gas pipeline and storage infrastructure to deliver hydrogen produced by renewable sources. A fifth is a gradual retraining of the energy workforce to participate in the burgeoning green economy. The The sixth major component of the climate model is land restoration. Malte Mainshausen, co-author, founding director of the Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne in Australia, says, citing a growing body of research, we show that using land restoration efforts to meet negative emission requirements, along with the transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, gives the world a good chance of staying below the 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Natural climate solutions, including everything from restoring natural forests, grasslands and wetlands, to improving soil fertility through regenerative agricultural practices like agroforestry, silvopasture and cover crops. These solutions not only absorb carbon, they also dramatically increase sustainable livelihoods in the developing world, offering improved water supplies, reduced soil erosion and higher quality of crop yields. The 1.5 degrees Celsius model shows just how important our natural ecosystems are. Carl Burkhardt, managing director of One Earth, says, nature is the missing key. While the renewable energy transition is imperative to solving the climate crisis, it isn't enough. Currently, wildlands and oceans absorb 1/2 of all our carbon dioxide emissions. As this climate model shows, in order to keep global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we have to keep our natural carbon sinks intact, scale up restoration efforts, and shift to regenerative agriculture. Without them, we have no future. Land use sector should be a big part of the climate solution. Unfortunately, because of rampant deforestation and unsustainable industrial agriculture and livestock practices, it is a net emitter of greenhouse gas pollution. Many efforts, like the New York Declaration on Forests, is working to halt deforestation by 2030, and United Nations Sustainable Development Goals 15 calls ending up to this destructive practice. The climate model shows that by protecting natural ecosystems and completely phasing out deforestation in the 2030s, we can maintain the integrity of the carbon sinks, and those sinks that are so vital to rebalancing our global climate system. The newly released climate model is part of the larger One Earth initiative, which builds upon the latest science to create a vision for the world that is possible in 2050, a world in which humanity and nature can coexist and thrive together. The vision is based upon three pillars of action: 100% renewable energy, the protection and restoration of 50% of the world's lands and oceans, and a transition to regenerative agriculture. Together, these pillars of action give us a global roadmap to tackle the climate crisis and to ensure a sustainable future for all of Earth's inhabitants. After 20 years of negotiations, the world governments came together under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, and established the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. They created a structure in which countries could submit pledges called Nationally Determined Commitments, or NDCs, that would be added together to achieve the target of staying well below 2 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, with the goal of gradually increasing commitments over time. While the Paris Climate Accord was a success in many ways, it's very clear that it will not deliver what is needed to achieve reductions sufficient to avoid a climate crisis. The latest analysis of government commitments by Climate Action Tracker estimates the current pledges would result in about 2.85 degrees Celsius of global temperature rise. There is hope, however, in the next commitment period that pledges will increase as the world wakes up to the disastrous impact of our current level of global warming. it's clear that all three pillars of action are required to achieve the goal of limiting warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. A transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, whilst incredibly aggressive, is not sufficient to get to a lower 50% likelihood of the target, much less a strong 67% likelihood. Environmental conservation, which avoids approximately 100 GT CO2 emissions from land use, changed relative to the reference case, plus 275 GT CO2 in negative emissions from environmental restoration gets us very close to that goal, but it takes an additional 25 GT CO2 in negative emissions from the agricultural sector to actually get to a strong likelihood of staying below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in average temperatures.
Around the World with Reporters.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. They support a family, and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians, and starved millions of women and their children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In a vote which fell almost totally along party lines, Donald Trump has become the first United States president to be impeached twice. Before Bill Clinton in 1998, there was only one other impeachment ever, reflecting how highly polarized the nation has become. The impeachment appears totally symbolic. A trial in the Senate and a two-thirds vote in favor is needed to actually convict and expel Trump. The Senate will not meet until January 19th, and Joe Biden will be inaugurated as president on January 20th.
Trump will be out of the office in 7 days. I mean, you know, like, I think that I understand and I'm sympathetic to people who want him out earlier, but I just don't think that it's the a priority of anybody who wants to make sure that this doesn't continue. And the goal should be to cut across the sympathies for these right-wing actions.
Just 1 week earlier, the entire world was shocked after a protest burst into the Capitol building, the home of America's parliament, stopping the counting of the Electoral College's disputed presidential votes. Anger, accusations, despair, and emotional outbursts immediately swept the nation and may not lessen even after impeachment. Some top media have compared the events, which occurred on the date 1-6, to 9-11. The Democrat-dominated House of Representatives successfully charged Trump with incitement to insurrection so quickly that many wonder if they have set a dangerous precedent of a so-called snap impeachment. Worries are widespread that the only practical result of the historic impeachment is even more division in a nation already racked by the coronavirus, racial strife, police brutality, years of tremendous cultural disunity, and economic catastrophe.
I think that impeachment is it's a good side dish, but it should not be the focus of anybody who considers themselves to be on the left. I understand why the center might do that, why neoliberals might do it, but Keynesian, you know, if you will, actions such as the $2,000, universal health care, that these things need to be put forth to undermine the growth of the right, the growing right, which I don't think impeachment is going to address.
The controversial decision of the House of Representatives came after the FBI warned that armed anti-inauguration protests are expected across all 50 state capitals starting on January 16th and ending on Inauguration Day at the earliest. The United States will remain in a historic state of tension and animosity until then, and maybe even long after. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah
has a very high malnutrition.